A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He says anthropology is one of those fields where most people, himself included, aren't quite sure what it actually covers. He's seen anthropologists discussing non-human behavior, which muddies the water further. And if it is the study of human behavior, how's it different from sociology? He wants us to unpack three things: what anthropologists actually do day to day, where they work, and what unique lens they bring to problems. Which, honestly, is a question I've never thought to ask, and now I'm annoyed I haven't.
It's one of those disciplines everybody's heard of and almost nobody can define. And the non-human thing is interesting, he's not wrong. Primatologists often sit in anthropology departments. Jane Goodall's work with chimpanzees is anthropological in method, even though her subjects aren't human, so already we're in weird territory.
Jane Goodall is an anthropologist.
She's a primatologist and ethologist, but her fieldwork method, long-term immersion, detailed observation, building relationships with subjects over years, that's pure anthropology. She was mentored by Louis Leakey, the paleoanthropologist. The intellectual lineage runs straight through anthropology, and that tells you something about what the field actually is. It's not just the study of humans, it's the study of human and near-human experience through deep, sustained, qualitative immersion.
Anthropology is method, not subject matter.
That's a huge part of it, and it's what separates it from sociology right out of the gate. A sociologist might design a survey, run regressions on census data, build statistical models. An anthropologist moves into the village for 18 months, learns the language, eats the food, gets invited to weddings and funerals, takes thousands of pages of field notes. The method is ethnography, which literally means writing about people. And it's slow, expensive, and impossible to automate. That's a standard ethnographic fieldwork cycle. Bronisław Malinowski, one of the founding figures, spent years in the Trobriand Islands during World War I. He was actually interned there as an enemy alien. He was Polish. The islands were under Australian administration, and he just kept working. The book that came out of it, Argonauts of the Western Pacific, basically invented modern fieldwork methodology.
Interned by accident, and decided to invent a discipline while waiting it out.
Here's the key thing he established, participant observation. You don't just watch, you try to see the world through their categories, not yours. The goal is what anthropologists call the emic perspective, the insider's view, as opposed to the edic, the external analytical framework.
If a sociologist studies religious attendance by counting who shows up and cross-referencing demographics, the anthropologist is in the pew, learning the hymns, and trying to understand what it feels like when prayer doesn't get answered.
And that's not to say one approach is better. They answer different questions. Sociology tends toward breadth. Large samples, generalizable findings, statistical significance. Anthropology tends toward depth, small samples, thick description, contextual understanding. The classic line is that sociology explains what people do, anthropology explains what it means.
That's a term of art.
From Clifford Geertz, he argued that a wink and a blink are physically identical, same muscle movements, but socially they're completely different acts. A thin description says his eyelid contracted. A thick description says he was practicing a burlesque wink as defined within a locally understood hierarchy of conspiratorial signaling. Anthropology is in the business of thick description.
A sociologist counts the winks. An anthropologist learns the conspiracy.
Gets invited to the secret meetings, which, by the way, is why the method has ethical complications that statistics don't. If you spend 2 years embedded with a community and then publish findings they don't like, you may have burned relationships that can't be repaired. The American Anthropological Association has a whole code of ethics about this. Primary obligation is to the people you study, not to the institution that funds you, not even to knowledge production.
That's actually a pretty radical stance for an academic discipline. Your primary duty is to your subjects.
And it comes out of some genuinely ugly history. Early anthropology was deeply entangled with colonialism. Administrators would call in anthropologists to help govern colonized populations more effectively. There's a reason the field has spent decades in self-examination. The AAA Ethics Code is partly a response to that legacy.
All right, so we've got a method, long-term immersion, participant observation, thick description, and an ethical stance. But you said primatologists are in anthropology departments. What's the unifying thread there? Because a chimpanzee doesn't have insider categories you can learn.
The unifying thread is the comparative project. Anthropology asks, what is human nature and what is culturally specific? The only way to answer that is comparison, across cultures, across time, and across species. If you find something that exists in all human societies, that's interesting. If you find it in chimpanzee societies too, that's even more interesting, because it suggests a deeper evolutionary route. Conversely, if you find something that varies wildly between human groups, say concepts of fairness, or marriage norms, or how grief is expressed, then you know it's not hardwired, it's cultural.
Anthropology is trying to figure out which of our behaviors come from biology, and which come from culture, and the way to do that is to look at the full range of human variation.
The range is staggering. There are societies without numbers above 3, societies without concepts of private property, societies where biological paternity is considered irrelevant, a child has multiple fathers, societies where time isn't linear. Every time you think you found a human universal, there's an ethnographic counterexample somewhere in the record.
The societies without numbers thing, that's real?
The Paraha people of the Amazon, studied extensively by Daniel Everett, they have no exact number words, no fixed color terms, no creation myths, and no recursion in their language, which, by the way, threw a grenade into Chomsky's theory of universal grammar. Everett was originally a missionary sent to convert them. He ended up an atheist anthropologist. The field does that to people.
Wait! A missionary goes to convert a group, spends enough time understanding their worldview, and loses his own faith instead. That's the most anthropology outcome imaginable.
It really is. And it gets at something essential. The method doesn't just produce knowledge about them, it changes you. Ethnographic fieldwork is psychologically intense. Culture shock is real, and so is reverse culture shock when you come home. You stop seeing your own society as normal. You start seeing it as one weird configuration among many.
Which brings us to the second part of the prompt. Where are these people employed? Because move to a village for 2 years and have your worldview shattered doesn't sound like it scales.
It doesn't, and that's been a tension in the field for decades. The academic job market for anthropologists has been shrinking since the 1990s. Tenure-track positions are scarce. But here's what's interesting. Anthropologists have quietly spread into places you'd never expect. Intel has a team of in-house anthropologists. They study how people actually use technology in their homes and workplaces, not how the engineers imagine they use it. Genevieve Bell, an Australian anthropologist, ran Intel's user experience research for years and basically invented the field of tech anthropology. She's now a distinguished professor and runs the ANU School of Cybernetics, but her career started by convincing a chip manufacturer that they needed someone who understood human meaning-making.
A chip manufacturer. What does an anthropologist tell Intel that a focus group doesn't?
A focus group tells you what people say they want. Ethnography tells you what they actually do. Those are often completely different things. Bell's team discovered, for example, that in many Asian households, the television isn't a viewing device. It's a household altar of sorts, always on, providing ambient presence. The living room is organized around it. That's not something people would tell you in a survey because they don't think of it as noteworthy. It's just how life works. But if you're designing a set-top box or a smart TV interface, you need to know that.
The anthropologist is the person who notices that the obvious thing nobody talks about is actually the most important thing.
That's a pretty good one-sentence job description, and it applies across domains. Anthropologists work at Google, Microsoft, and IDEO, the design firm. They work in hospitals, studying how medical errors happen not as individual mistakes, but as systemic failures in communication and workflow. They work for government agencies. The CDC has medical anthropologists who study how disease spreads through cultural practices. During the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, anthropologists were essential because they could explain why standard quarantine protocols were failing. In some communities, funeral practices involve touching and washing the body, and asking people to stop wasn't just a logistics problem, it was a meaning problem.
You're telling people to abandon their sacred obligations to the dead. Compliance isn't the right framework.
And public health officials who don't get that will design interventions that fail, then blame the population for being irrational. The anthropologist's value is saying, they're not irrational. Their behavior makes perfect sense within their worldview. Let's work with that rather than against it.
Applied anthropology is basically translation between worlds that don't understand each other.
Increasingly, that's where the jobs are. The Discover Anthropology site from the Royal Anthropological Institute profiles anthropologists working in advertising, market research, urban planning, international development, and military contexts. That last one is controversial. The Human Terrain System program embedded anthropologists with U military units in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the AAA condemned it as an unethical application of anthropological expertise.
Because your primary ethical obligation is to the people you study, and if your employer is the military, those obligations are in direct conflict.
The anthropologist embedded with a combat unit can't simultaneously serve the community and serve the mission. The AAA said it was a violation of the ethics code. The program was eventually shut down, though the debate about anthropology and national security hasn't gone away.
Employment sectors. Tech, healthcare, government, military, development, advertising. Plus, whatever remains of academia. That's broader than I expected.
There's corporate strategy consulting. Reedy Associates, a firm founded by anthropologists, does ethnographic research for companies trying to understand their customers in ways that surveys can't capture. They've worked with Lego, Adidas, Samsung. The pitch is basically, you already have all the quantitative data. What you're missing is the qualitative insight that tells you what the numbers mean.
What's an example of that?
Lego spent years convinced that kids wanted simpler, more instant gratification toys because attention spans were shrinking. Reedy did ethnographic work, actually watching kids play in their homes over extended periods, and found something different. Kids were drawn to complexity and mastery. What they didn't want was prescripted play. They wanted open-ended systems where skill mattered. That insight directly informed Lego's turnaround strategy. The company had been designing itself towards shallowness based on a misreading of market data. Anthropologists corrected the misreading.
The unique value proposition is, your data is lying to you because you don't understand the context it was generated in, and I'm the person who can go find the context.
That's a hard sell sometimes, because the method doesn't produce tidy deliverables. You can't run a regression on field notes. The output is narrative, interpretation, thick description. In a business culture that worships quantification, the anthropologist is always saying, I know you want a number, but the number is meaningless without the story.
Which makes me think about the third part of the prompt, the unique lens. Because what you're describing is almost a philosophical stance as much as a method. There's an epistemological claim here that some kinds of knowledge can only be acquired through immersion and relationship.
That's exactly what makes it distinct. Sociology, at least mainstream quantitative sociology, operates in a positivist framework. There's an objective reality out there, and we can measure it. Anthropology, especially since the interpretive turn in the 70s and 80s, tends to be more constructivist. It acknowledges that the researcher is part of what's being studied. Your presence changes the situation. Your categories shape what you see. Objectivity is a goal, but it's a negotiated, reflexive kind of objectivity, not the view from nowhere.
Reflexivity meaning what?
Meaning, you're constantly examining your own position. Who are you to these people? What do they want from you? How is your gender, your nationality, your race, your age shaping what people tell you and what you notice? A good ethnography includes the ethnographer in the frame. It doesn't pretend you're a neutral recording device.
Anthropology is the discipline that admits the observer effect and makes it part of the method, instead of treating it as noise.
And that's why it's uniquely good at certain kinds of problems. Any problem where the relevant variables can't be isolated in a lab. Any problem where meaning and context are the whole point. Any problem where the people you're studying have reasons for what they do that won't show up in a survey because they don't think to articulate them.
What are the problems where anthropology fails?
Anything that requires statistical generalization. If you want to know what percentage of Americans believe something, don't ask an anthropologist. The sample sizes are too small. the site selection isn't random, and the whole method is optimized for depth over breadth. An anthropologist can tell you a lot about one community. They can't tell you whether that community is representative.
That's the trade-off. Sociology gives you the map. Anthropology gives you one street, in exhaustive, almost psychedelic detail.
The metaphor I'd use is, sociology gives you the satellite photo. Anthropology gives you the novel about one block.
If I'm an employer deciding whether to hire an anthropologist, what am I getting that I can't get from a sociologist or a psychologist?
You're getting someone who knows how to shut up and listen. That sounds trivial, but it's not. Most professionals are trained to have answers. Anthropologists are trained to sit with not knowing for extended periods, to resist the urge to impose frameworks prematurely, to notice the thing that everyone in the organization takes for granted, but nobody questions. It's a discipline of cultivated ignorance. You deliberately set aside what you think you know so you can see what's actually there.
I like that. It's the opposite of what most credentials signal.
It's uncomfortable, which is why organizations that hire anthropologists often don't know what to do with them. They want insights. The anthropologist says, "Slow down, I'm still figuring out what questions to ask." That doesn't fit quarterly reporting cycles.
The career path for an anthropology PhD is, convince someone to pay you to tell them they're asking the wrong questions, using a method that takes 18 months and produces no numbers.
Yet the people who do it successfully become indispensable. Genevieve Bell at Intel. Gillian Tett at the Financial Times. She has a PhD in cultural anthropology and covered the 2008 financial crisis by treating bankers as an ethnographic tribe with their own rituals, hierarchies, and unspoken assumptions. She predicted the crisis before most economists did because she was paying attention to the culture of the trading floor, not just the balance sheets.
Wait, the FT journalist who called the financial crisis is an anthropologist?
PhD from Cambridge. Did fieldwork in Tajikistan on marriage practices, then became a financial journalist and realized she could use the same lens. Her book, Fool's Gold, is essentially an ethnography of the J.P. Morgan derivatives desk. She described how the bankers had constructed an insular social world where certain risks became literally unthinkable, not in the casual sense, in the structural sense. The culture made it impossible to ask certain questions.
She didn't beat the quants at their own game. She played a completely different game they didn't know existed.
That's the move. Anthropologists don't try to out-quantify the quants. They look at the quants as a tribe and ask, what are their origin myths? Who has status and why? What's taboo to say out loud? And very often, the answers explain things the models miss.
This is making me think about the field differently. I always assumed anthropology was the dusty discipline. You know, pith helmets and studying remote tribes. But what you're describing is a general-purpose toolkit for understanding any human system from the inside.
That's exactly what it's become. The remote tribe framing is partly the colonial legacy I mentioned, and the field has spent 50 years moving away from it. Contemporary anthropology is just as likely to study startup culture, or emergency room workflow, or the social world of cryptocurrency traders, or how climate scientists construct their models. The subject isn't exotic people. The subject is, how do groups of humans construct shared meaning, and what happens as a result?
The non-human thing Daniel noticed? Where does that fit in the contemporary field? Is that a significant part of anthropology or a weird edge case?
It's a significant subfield. Biological anthropology, which includes primatology, paleoanthropology, and human evolutionary biology. But it sits somewhat uneasily with cultural anthropology. The methods are completely different. A primatologist doesn't do participant observation in the same sense. And some cultural anthropologists are skeptical of evolutionary explanations for human behavior because they've been used to justify some pretty ugly stuff. Racial hierarchies, gender essentialism, that kind of thing.
There's an internal tension between the biological wing and the cultural wing.
There's been a running debate for decades. The cultural anthropologists tend to emphasize human plasticity and the power of social construction. The biological anthropologists emphasize evolutionary constraints and cross-species continuity. The best work usually integrates both, but the field doesn't always manage that integration gracefully.
It's almost like the discipline contains its own unresolved argument about human nature.
Which, in a way, is exactly what you'd want from a field that studies humans. If it had settled answers, it wouldn't be doing its job.
To pull the threads together. What anthropologists actually do is ethnography, long-term immersive fieldwork aimed at thick description and understanding meaning from the insider's perspective, where their employed has expanded from academia into tech, healthcare, government, development, consulting, and journalism. And the unique lens is this combination of deep listening, cultural relativism, and reflexive awareness that the observer is part of the system being observed. Plus an almost philosophical commitment to the idea that context isn't just background, it's the thing itself.
That's a solid summary. I'd add one more thing about the lens. Anthropology is fundamentally comparative in a way that most disciplines aren't. An economist studies markets. A political scientist studies states. An anthropologist studies the full range of ways humans have organized markets, states, families, religions, and everything else. The constant comparison across cultures produces a kind of intellectual humility. You stop thinking your society's arrangements are natural or inevitable. You start seeing them as one option among many.
Which is probably why anthropologists tend to be annoying at dinner parties. Every conversation turns into, well, in the society I studied.
The most annoying person at any gathering is the one who responds to every anecdote with a cross-cultural comparison. It's an occupational hazard.
All right, but here's a question. If anthropology is so useful, why isn't it better known? Why does Daniel, who's a smart guy, feel like he doesn't have a basic handle on what the field is?
Part of it is branding. Anthropology doesn't produce a clear professional identity the way economics or psychology does. There's no anthropology licensing exam, no standard industry designation. An anthropology PhD might end up in user research, or public health, or corporate strategy, or academia, and they'll all describe what they do differently. The field is defined by a method and a sensibility, not by a domain. That makes it hard to explain.
The discipline that's best at understanding other cultures' categories can't quite categorize itself.
There's probably a paper in that. An anthropologist would have a field day with it.
They'd need to do 18 months of fieldwork among the anthropologists.
Which has actually been done. There are ethnographies of anthropology departments. The field is reflexively self-devouring in exactly that way.
Of course there are.
I want to circle back to something about employment because I think it's surprising. The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects growth for anthropologist positions at about 6% over the next decade, which is average. But the real story is where the growth is happening. It's not in universities. It's in management consulting, scientific research services, and tech. The median salary is around $64,000, but the top-end applied positions, the Genevieve Bell trajectory, can go much higher. And the skill set travels well because every organization has culture problems. It doesn't know how to diagnose.
Every organization is a tribe with unspoken rules, status hierarchies, and origin myths. The anthropologist is the person who can read the room in a way the people in the room can't.
Read it sympathetically. That's the key. The anthropological stance isn't, these people are wrong. It's, these people have reasons, and my job is to understand those reasons from the inside. That's rare in organizational life. Most consultants come in with a framework and fit the organization to it. Anthropologists come in and let the organization teach them its framework.
Which is slower and messier and harder to sell. But when it works, it gets at things the framework-first approach misses entirely.
And I think that's the answer to the unique value, part of the prompt. The unique value of anthropology is that it's the discipline of not jumping to conclusions. In a world that rewards speed and confidence, the anthropologist is the person who says, let's sit with the ambiguity for a while. Let's not assume we know what's going on. Let's ask questions we don't have answers to and stay in that discomfort long enough for something genuine to emerge.
Which is also why it's a hard sell. Nobody puts tolerate ambiguity for extended periods in a job description.
They put problem-solving skills and critical thinking. Anthropology delivers those, but through a route that doesn't look like what hiring managers expect. The field has a communication problem, not a value problem.
If someone's interested in this, not necessarily getting a PhD, but developing the anthropological lens, what do they do?
They're surprisingly readable. They're essentially non-fiction narratives about how particular groups of people live and make meaning. Start with something like, the spirit catches you and you fall down. by Anne Fadiman, which is about a Hmong family and the American medical system colliding over a child with epilepsy. It's not technically an ethnography, Fadiman is a journalist, but it's deeply anthropological in method and sensibility. Or read actual ethnographies like Philippe Bourgois's In Search of Respect about crack dealers in East Harlem. The core skill is learning to see the world from inside someone else's categories, and you can practice that anywhere.
You don't need to move to a village.
The village is wherever you're not paying attention.
That's almost profound.
I have my moments.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In ancient Turkmenistan, physicians of the Parthian era routinely prescribed a diet of fermented camel milk and crushed locusts to treat melancholy, on the theory that the locust's sudden, chaotic movement pattern would counteract the sluggish humors of the melancholic patient, while the sour milk would shock the liver back into proper function.
Fermented camel milk and crushed locusts.
I mean, at least the reasoning was internally consistent. To wrap this up, I think the thing I'd leave listeners with is that anthropology is the discipline that takes culture seriously as a causal force. Not as decoration, not as a residual category for things economists can't explain, but as the fundamental medium through which humans experience and act in the world. And in a moment when we're all navigating cross-cultural encounters constantly. Online, at work, in politics, the capacity to step outside your own categories and inhabit someone else's, even temporarily, is maybe the most undervalued skill there is.
If nothing else, you'll be insufferable at dinner parties.
Small price to pay.
This has been My Weird Prompts, with me, Korn, and my brother, Herman Pubbleberry, produced by the endlessly patient Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps people find the show. We'll be back soon.
With more questions you didn't know you needed answered.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.